carefully adjust the load so that in my example of 5 watts being indicated reversed when there's really nothing there because of a lack of directivity in the reverse mode, it's by mistake letting some of the forward power lead through 5 watts of it in my example. And now you set up your antenna, carefully tune its visor so that it's got 5 watts of reflected power of just the right phase angle. Your output of your directivity of your directional coupler will now go to zero in the reverse mode. In the reverse mode, it'll go to zero because you're putting two things 180 degrees out of phase that are equal in power inside of the directional coupler. So you can get all kinds of crazy readings out of a less than ideal directional coupler when you're trying to really figure out how to properly adjust an antenna tuner. So what I'm talking about is when you're getting down to the nitty-gritty of trying to measure insertion loss, some of the errors you can easily run into. I just told you one of them. Let me drop it.
Let me point something out there.
Go ahead, Eric.
Like when it gets to the point that really throws him, well, he's got a service monitor. You can think of it as a spectrum analyzer with a tracking generator. He sets it up, and he sets up his black box so that he thinks that it's good with his antenna. He now disconnects that and hooks it up to his service monitor, which is a tracking generator spectrum analyzer. The thing that he's not realizing is, one, okay, he adjusts the resonance of that antenna tuner for that random length of wire, which is whatever number of thousands of ohms of the piece. He's now hooking it up to his spectrum analyzer, which has a 50 ohm load, and it sorts the pieces to 50 ohms. And whatever the sum and difference products are at 50 ohms versus where he's had his antenna connected, now the output voltage is going to be way different than what he's expecting to see. So just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I agree with you, Eric. Joe, you've used good common sense in this one. Unfortunately, Mother Nature has made this particular situation a couple of times more nasty, calculated. When it comes to the, what I'm looking at, what am I talking about here now? So-called, what's the branch of mathematics where you're using negative square root of minus one?
Imaginary numbers.
That's the word I was looking for. The imaginary number problem is part of what's going on here. So that when you adjust your antenna tuner on your real ZEP antenna, and then you now try to put instrumentation back into that port, which is in theory a 50 ohm source, and it's going to be something less than ideal 50 ohms, but still, that's such a huge impedance difference. Eric was speculating your antenna might really have 1,000 ohms, and now you're putting 50 ohm instrumentation on that port instead of the antenna, and trying to make a judgment. Good common sense, boy, that can get you a lot of trouble. So the main point we're making here, Eric and I are trying to make, is that to try to measure the insertion loss of an antenna tuner under real working conditions where it's really correcting a significant visor of an antenna, that's an extremely difficult thing to do accurately. Let me drop.
Okay, but you did follow what I said afterwards, right?
No matter what you said afterwards, where that step can easily create tremendous amounts of error, no matter what you said afterwards, it's very hard to put faith in it, Joe. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay, initially as it was adjusted into my random antenna, like the antenna wire, I agree with what, I thought that's what was happening, and I agree with what Eric said. There's got to be a severe mismatch between my load antenna, the antenna load, and the impedance of the service monitor. Okay, big difference. I realized that right away. But when I readjusted the controls, I saw that indication diminished to about like 3.2 decibels. Instead of 8, it went down to about 3.2. But the interesting thing enough is when I had it tuned that way, I then reversed the connections again, even retuning the control slightly again. I now saw a difference of about like 0.6 decibels going from the antenna side to the DX side. It was different one way than the other way, irregardless of if I tuned the controls or not. For maximum match, calling out a question my test score. That was part of my second part of my question. The first one I sort of figured that's probably what was going on. But why do you think I saw a difference going backwards from the antenna port to the TX port?
is the actual structure of the antenna generator, whether it's a pi, a T, an L, because the position of the coil and how much of the coil and the tap and so on and so forth versus where the capacitors are, the phase angle is going to be different.
Yeah, he's got a, it's essentially a pi network. And he's, when he's trying to use all of the coil plus some extra coil that he added, very, very smart thing to do, by the way, taking it down to 1800 kilohertz. So he's using the full coil, the full air variable capacitor on the input side, and the full air variable capacitor on the output side. So it's a pure pi network. But the, one of the biggest problems going on here, Joe, is the experiment got contaminated. Let me drop. Let me make a wild guess that your NFED SEP antenna really has a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, and it might be that high. And now when you're using the antenna tuner to correct for that, that antenna tuner is working pretty hard. But as long as these controls don't run out of range, I believe you can make a pure 50-ohm source on the exciter side into that 10-to-1 reservoir of your ZEP antenna on the other side of the antenna tuner. The antenna tuner can do that. Under that condition, under that real-world condition in your shack, you want to know the insertion loss of your antenna tuner. No matter what you do now to rearrange instrumentation to measure that insertion loss, you do not want to touch any of the controls on the antenna tuner. If you do, then you might be adjusting it for a 1-to-1 instead of a 10-to-1, and that's an entirely different insertion loss. So as long as if you touch any of the controls in the antenna tuner, you've got a very contaminated measurement in my mind. And now, under that 10-to-1 in my example, 10-to-1 visuar situation, to try to measure the true insertion loss of the antenna tuner, a good smart engineer would be driven up a wall trying to do that and evaluate all the potential errors of doing it. Because on the output side, the apparent forward power is going to be greater than the real power the transmitter is generating. And now how you figure out what's going on, you might have 100 watts coming out of the transmitter. Let me drop it. On the output end of the antenna tuner, you might see 150 watts going forward and 50 watts coming back before you have any errors of that particular instrumentation. And now you try to figure out what is the true insertion loss of the antenna tuner. A naive person would just say, oh, 100 watts minus 50, there's really 100 watts being, 150 minus 50 is 100, so there's 100 on the input side, 100 on the output side, and the insertion loss is zero. Because of the errors you can easily get with those crazy measurements. Now you've got to worry about the directivity of that particular slug, of that particular Berg 43 watt meter on the output side when it saw the 150 forward and the 50 coming back. So without using calorimetry, I think you can easily build up more errors than the measurement you're trying to make. A reasonable antenna tuner is going to be running 97% efficiency in the real world. And you can confirm that real fast by thermal. In your particular case, Joe, where your thermal imaging device was being driven crazy by the RF energy present, you're measuring the amount of heat of a coil. Well, once you turn off the transmitter, the heat of the coil is going to go away, but it takes minutes to do that. So that even though the RF energy is affecting your thermal imaging device like crazy, you can run the key down long enough to come up to steady state temperature, turn it off, and within a couple of seconds, make the measurement. Because no matter what it is, it's a massive object, it can't cool off that fast. If the real answer was 70 degrees, but it cooled off to 68 degrees by the time you made the measurement, that's good enough, if you know what I mean. I was giving you degrees centigrade, by the way. So there's ways around it. But now when you operate it with the cover off, again, it's a contaminated measurement because now a little bit more of the RF energy is being radiated. If you could accurately measure input power and output power with the cover off, you may have another 5 watts of error because you radiated 5 watts out of the box because the cover isn't there. So what you're trying to do is a real good piece of science here, Eric, but you're walking across one hell of a minefield that isn't so obvious. And so it's not your fault. The majority of engineers that Eric and I know, the majority of smart engineers that Eric and I know would have a hell of a lot of trouble doing this set of measurements in a way that's traceable to the bureau. It's an extremely difficult measurement. When I get a chance, I'm going to take a look at some of those articles as to how ARL claimed they did it. And I hope they gave us enough words. But if they didn't do it by calorimetry, if they did it by Berg wattmeter-like measurements, and even if they used good directional couplers, still, I'd love to see how they did it, because I think the rate of errors in the way they did it versus the magnitude of the loss they think the antenna tuner is giving might be the same. In other words, they may think that the antenna tuner is giving 10 dB of loss, and oh, by the way, there's plus or minus 10 watts of loss, and there might be plus or minus 10 watts of error in the way they use the instrumentation. Now, it's not easy to figure out what's going on. So don't take this too hard, Joe, but what you're trying to do is only 10 times more difficult than first meets the eye. W2RYY, we're going to come back to this a little bit later. W2RYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Good point you made about taking the cover off. I thought about that too. You have source radiating power. You're going to upset the apple cart by the measurements going off, because now it's not an enclosed shield. So, okay. Well, this thing's a Dentron AT. Excuse me, it's a Dentron. It says 160-10 AT transmatch. So if you happen to find what they call that for loss on the thing, it'd be pretty sure to know what somebody claims it's supposed to be. But I think the whole thing was just more or less my, for sparking my curiosity because of just the way things are, and so forth. But, and you think because of the, just where this is instructed, I would get a different reading with test equipment measuring one way compared to the other way, correct?
Yeah, if you twisted any of the controls, when you now use the test equipment instead of the real world, it's a contaminated measurement. A real antenna tuner is going to have a certain amount of insertion loss when it's looking into a 1-to-1 Vizsla. It's going to have a different insertion loss when it's looking at a 5-to-1 Vizsla. It's going to have a different insertion loss of a 10-to-1 Vizsla. And the 10-to-1 Vizsla, it's going to have a number of different losses depending on the phase angle of the 10-to-1 Vizsla. As I've told you guys many times, if the antenna tuner manufacturer was really doing a thorough job on each band, 160, 80, 40, 20, on each one of those bands, it would present to you a Smith chart where certain sections of the Smith chart would be colored in, because the antenna tuner will match in those colored in areas, and the assumption is that it does not give you a good match in the non-colored in areas. Each one of those Smith charts on each one of those bands is going to be different. On top of that, let me drop. If now they went the next step, and in the colored in area where the antenna tuner does give you a nearly perfect match, in the colored in area, the color would not be constant. There'd be bright areas and dim areas depending on the insertion loss of the antenna tuner for that particular phase angle. There are certain phase angles of a 10-to-1 Vizsla where the current flowing through the coil is a hell of a lot higher than other phase angles. And if the coil is the major, if the current flowing through the coil and its resistance is the major loss of, major cause of the insertion loss, you're going to get a different insertion loss for each Vizsla and each phase angle of that Vizsla. Therefore, that Smith chart is going to be a very fancy colored-in chart where there's either different shades of color or different brightnesses of color telling you insertion loss even in the so-called good areas. So as you can see, you're getting some of the hints now, Joe, as to how the experiment became contaminated when you went from the real antenna, which maybe is a 10-to-1, to anything else, and then you twisted the controls on the antenna tuner. There was a double error in contaminated measurement during that procedure, and it was being done with the cover off and so on. So it's not your fault, Joe. What you're trying to do is a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. We're going to come back to this a little bit later, and maybe in the next couple of weeks we'll be discussing it. Antenna tuners, let me drop this. The guys on 20 meters, so to speak, are giving a hell of a lot of flack to antenna tuners that they do not deserve. To first accuse it of taking all the reflective power and throwing it away, absolutely not true. How can it do that? If it's not radiating it because it's a well-shielded box, and if it's not getting hot, then within what the hell laws of physics can it throw power away? the law of conservation of energy says energy cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in form. Okay? If your antenna tuner is throwing away that energy, what the hell form is it putting it in? Is it making it an ultraviolet wave that's sneaking out of the holes of the cage of the antenna tuner? I'm being a little ridiculous here, but you can see what I'm saying. Okay, the next person who's on our list, I hope he's still with us. This guy's probably going to hang in there. The next guy on our list is John, KC2WGB. What would you like to talk about tonight, John? K2IW in the TechNet. Hello, John. One last call. Maybe he got called away for a minute. KC2WGB, I know you want to be on the list because you've got a question to be discussed. You got it, John. KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Sorry about that, Dick. Let me get the beep. All right, this question's a little involved. I'll give you a diagram, and we can cover some of it. Maybe we'll do some of it this week and some of it next week. Need a little pencil?
Fire away, Daddy-O.
Very good. Okay, got a horn antenna, 6-inch diameter round, it's a coffee can, and that's my receiving antenna. My transmitting antenna is connected to the generator. It's horizontally mounted, and I'm operating at 1.67 gigahertz. And that frequency is where I have perfect Q on that antenna. It has very nice gain. Now my question is, if what I'm experiencing is reflection or absorption? Let me let it drop. All right, the first experiment was I have a coil made up of 5 turns and a 14-gauge wire, approximately 1.25 inches in diameter. They're on the end of a wooden shaft. And what I do is I pass that in between the path, which is a 1 meter distance between the transmitter and the receiving antenna. When I place that in about, I would say about 2/3 of the way, nearest the antenna, and I rotate that coil, I notice it absorbing energy, or maybe it's reflecting energy. Personally, I think it's absorbing energy, but it goes down approximately 12 dB. Does that sound like absorption or reflection to you, Dick?
By the way, a horn 10 inches in diameter at 1.67 gigs has a calculated gain of about 10.7.
6-inch diameter.
How many inch diameter?
6-inch diameter.
Okay, therefore the 10.7 is going to be a lower number, like 7. It's got around 7 dB of gain. I'll go with the real number. Now, you put what kind of a device in front of it at what distance and measured what power? Run that by again. So you've got a signal generator going into the horn, and you're putting something in front of it, and now you're measuring the apparent energy picked up by that device. Is that roughly what you're describing to me, John? Go ahead.
Generator is putting out a 0 dBm signal, 1 meter separation. It's a simple coil of 5 turns, and they're shorted, so we have just like a 5-turn loop on a stick. The antenna is receiving a signal, according to the spectrum analyzer, at about minus 25 dB. Now, when I put the coil in between the path and I rotate it or tilt it, I notice that signal gets attenuated by about, it can be between like 12 and near 15 dB.
Okay, a 6-inch diameter horn, probably impedance matched at 1.67 gigs, 6.29 dB of gain over ISO is a calculated number. You've got 5 turns of coil of some diameter in front of it, and you said it's 5 shorted turns. Okay? By some means, you're impedance matching those 5 and shorted turns, and now you're putting that into some kind of receiver instrumentation. Give me a few, and it's 1 meter away. Those 5 turns of shorted coil, how are you receiving signal from that? Is it impedance matched? Over with you, John, KQLAW.
Okay, they're not five shorted turns. It's five turns, but the beginning and the end of those five turns is shorted. Approximately an inch and a quarter in diameter, five turns, number 14 gauge wire. I have no instrumentation on the probe or those coil, the coil that I'm talking about. I'm watching the reception at the antenna. And I also have a third spectrum analyzer that's watching on a freelance antenna, which is a distance away from that. So I'm noticing that it absorbs a quite amount of signal, or is reflecting the signal, and I was just wondering what you thought.
Okay, you got a horn as an illuminator, you got a five-turn coil in front of it, and you're receiving something on the antenna. Okay, are there three objects involved here? A transmitting horn, a receiving antenna, and a coil that you're changing the orientation of the coil 1 meter away? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, the transmitting antenna is just a horizontal piece of wire hooked to the generator. The horn is the receiving antenna, and they're spaced approximately 1 meter.
Okay, the horizontal piece of wire from the signal generator is 1 meter away. The 6-inch diameter horn is the receiving device. And somewhere in the environment is also this five-turn coil that's 1 meter away. Are they in a triangular pattern? Is one shadowing the other? What's the arrangement of the five-turn coil, the horizontal piece of wire? Are they both 1 meter away from the horn? And how close are they to each other? Over to you, John.
The separation from the transmit antenna to the receive antenna is 1 meter. The coil is taped to a wooden stick that I'm just putting up from underneath into the path of the signal, and then rotating it and tilting it, and notice I can almost snuff the signal out totally.
I'm slowly getting the picture of your experiment, John. And even if that five-turn coil was itself going into a transmission line and perfectly impedance matched, good common sense would tell you that, hey, it's absorbing a certain amount of signal coming from the horizontal wire from the signal generator, and therefore it's subtracting a certain amount of signal that's going to be going to the 6-inch diameter horn. Good common sense. In general, every antenna has a effective receiving area and a scattering area, as well as a loss area and a bunch of other areas. But in the case of a simple dipole, when you've got a perfectly impedance matched simple dipole, and if right now it's receiving a 1 milliwatt signal, you do a careful measurement in all 360 degrees of azimuth and elevation space, all 4 pi star radians, all 41,000 square degrees on the surface of the sphere. If you observe all of the power in the vicinity of that dipole that's now receiving 1 milliwatt of power, you'll find out it's also radiating 1 milliwatt of power. You could say 2 milliwatts was really going into that dipole antenna by way of its impedance match in the transmission line. You had access to 1 milliwatt of it, and it was re-radiating another milliwatt of the 2 milliwatts that went into it. Every device called receiving antenna with an impedance match is re-radiating some power. It's got a scattering area. Let me drop. In your particular case, your five-turn coil is not going to be scattering half the power. It's going to be scattering 99.9%. You ain't got a transmission line connected to it. Assuming it's made out of lossless materials, no matter what power it has on reception, it's re-radiating that power. If it receives a milliwatt, it's going to re-radiate damn close to a milliwatt. However, the polarization of the milliwatt it receives and the polarization of the milliwatt it retransmits do not have to be the same. In general, they're going to be different. So therefore, even though your horn might be set up for horizontal polarization of reception, and you've got a horizontal piece of wire radiating into that horn, that five-turn coil thing can re-radiate in such a way that it can create a null, it can create circular polarization, it can do all kinds of things. I think the main question you're asking is how in the world, with 1 meter of separation, can you set up a coil in between the two and create a null? How do you stop the signal from getting from the horizontal piece of wire into the horn? I think that's the nature of your question now. I think you're asking, how in the world can it stop the transmission? Is that the question, John? And by the way, when it's creating that null, how deep a null did it create? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
About a 10 to 12 dB null.
Yes. And by the way, you know you were getting reflections in the room from the table, the floor, the walls. In other words, the number of signals getting into that 6-inch diameter horn was a very large number. In theory, the main direct signal from the horizontal piece of wire connected to the signal generator, in theory, that was the dominant signal. Tell me what else was in the environment. How in the world did you suspend the horizontal piece of wire? How did you suspend the signal generator? How did you suspend the horn? The horn's going into something like a spectrum analyzer. How is it suspended? There's a hell of a lot of other things in the environment. Now, whenever you're doing an antenna range test, think you're testing an antenna. You're really testing the antenna in that particular environment. And everything in that environment that is capable of reflecting a signal is doing that. And so there's a hell of a lot of signals simultaneously going into the horn. The direct one, the reflected one from the five turns, the reflected one from the table, the floor, and everything else. Describe some of the other environment, because I'm pretty sure you are not doing this in an anechoic chamber yet. Although the day will come when you're going to own an anechoic chamber. I see it coming. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Only if it'll keep the mosquitoes out, too. All right. Basically, the generator. It's an HP generator. Oh, it doesn't make any difference. I have an N connector plugged into it. There is a wire soldered to the center pin of the N connector. There is a ground plane of about 4 square inches soldered to the N connector also. The wire protrudes straight out horizontally. Got that picture?
Okay. So the wire is horizontal, radiating broadside into the horn. Does that mean the flat plate is now edgewise to the horn, and the flat plate is on the front cover of the signal generator, the Hewlett-Packard signal generator? Does that mean the signal generator is also roughly 1 meter away from the horn? Over to you, John.
Exactly true. Let me let the beep.
There's a lot of signal bouncing back and forth around that flat plate from the walls of the signal generator, bouncing back and forth. Not all that's being absorbed by your 6-inch diameter horn. You've got a fairly complicated environment here, John. I mean, your eye saw the horizontal piece of wire, and you assume that that's the only thing in the environment, as well as the 5-turn coil. Mother Nature is looking at all the other stuff. She's looking at the side wall of that signal generator, as well as other things that's supporting your structure. You've got a fairly complicated environment there, John. Go ahead.
No doubt. What I did was, before I started the experiment, I set up the frequencies, positioned the horn so that I would have the maximum gain. Now, when I move the horn slightly off target, the attenuation drops off drastically, and I do not have any other area when I move it around that I pick up a significant signal. So I have pretty good directivity, and I don't think I'm looking at 0 dBm output on that generator and a meter away. I don't think I have that problem. I could, but I haven't detected that. So, now, in the horn, it's a coffee can, metal coffee can of 6-inch diameter, about 6 inches deep. There is a BNC connector on the back, which allows me to plug in different connectors for antennas, and I can rotate them. It comes out as an L, comes straight out, and bends in an L with about 2 inches. I can swing that at 180 degrees to change polarity. And yes, I have it at a 45-degree angle. It looks at basically the 8 o'clock position, and that's how I get the maximum gain. It's odd because if I go to the 2 o'clock position, I don't get the same image. Stupid phone. So basically that's the setup so far. Any further questions?
Out of curiosity, the signal you were receiving from the horn, 1 meter away, when you swing the horn back and forth and up and down to maximum signal. Was the signal you were picking up roughly minus 20 dBm, John, go ahead?
Yes, approximately.
You know how I know that? I've done so many experiments at exactly 3 feet, which is very close to 1 meter. I know that three feet at 915 megacycles has a loss of 30.89 dB. So I assume you've got roughly 30 dB of free space loss. You've got a little bit of gain on the transmitting antenna. You've got 7 dB or so of dB of gain on the horn. And so I added and subtracted those numbers and came to the conclusion that you're going to see around minus 20 dBm. Okay. Isn't that amazing that just 3 feet of free space has 30.89 dB of loss, of apparent loss. It's not loss. A hell of a lot of the signal is going in all kinds of angles that your horn is not picking it up. That's why you think you see 30 dB of loss, and you've got the gains on each end that make it come out to 20. Now, I guess your main question now is, how in the world is that five turns creating the null? A 10 dB null is what I think you're saying. And when you say everything's at a 45 degree angle, does that mean the flat plate that the horizontal wire is sticking out of, is that at a 45 degree angle compared to the path between that wire and the horn? Is that what the 45 degrees means, John, go ahead?
Negative, Dick. The plate, which is the ground plane for the antenna, is perpendicular to the bench, and the wire comes out in the horizontal, is straight out at you if you were sitting at the bench. It comes directly out from the generator. The only thing I'm changing is the angle of the receiving antenna. I can rotate that 360 degrees right now. The best position is 8 o'clock.
Rotate it 360 degrees. Is that a rotation in azimuth, a rotation in elevation, a rotation in polarization? There's only three kinds of rotation. Which one are you talking about, John?
Polarity, Dick. It comes out from the back of the coffee can for about an inch and a half, then it's bent like an L for about 2 inches. And I can spin that around like the hand of a clock.
When you do that, is the polarization of the horn and the polarization of the wire, are they approximately parallel when the five turns is not there? Go ahead.
No, when I set it up, we have the horizontal transmitting antenna. The receiving horn is approximately 45 degrees down from the 9 o'clock position. It's at the 8 o'clock position. That's where I get the maximum signal. So when I have that set up, that's what I'm looking at. Then I insert the coil in between the path length.
Even before you put in the coil, explain to me how a purely horizontal wire transmitting what you believe is a purely horizontal signal, which should be 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock, is really coming out 1:30 to 7:30, if you know what I mean. That's the 45 degree angle you're talking about. Explain to me how 45 degrees of polarization rotation is taking place before you add the five turns. Explain that one to me, John. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm not moving the transmitting antenna. That's staying horizontal. The coffee can antenna, that little L, I can move that like the hand of a clock. My best signal reception is at the 8 o'clock position. 12 and 6, I have hardly any signal at all. But at 8 o'clock, I've got a beautiful signal coming out of the antenna. Unfortunately, I thought, well, 180 degrees, I'll go to 2 o'clock. Again, hardly any signal. So that's where I'm telling you the 45 degree tilt is. It's the receiving antenna tipped down to the 8 o'clock position.
Okay, so the 6-inch diameter horn is not a horn, it's a coffee can. It's a 6-inch diameter coffee can. It's got a probe inside that's going to something like a BNC connector. And when that probe is down at the 8 o'clock position, you get maximum signal. When you now put it at the 2 o'clock position, which is 180 degrees away, you should again see maximum. If you do not. Just explaining that, before you add the five turns, there's a huge bunch of mysteries going on right there, John. Over to you, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, and not moving the coffee can, just that antenna in there, why is it that at the 2 o'clock I figured I would have exactly the same position, the same signal, but I don't. It's almost zero. That, to me, was very confusing. So I know this is a little long for the TechNet, but it's a complicated issue.
The average guy that puts a probe into a coffee can antenna mounts the probe in the cylindrical side of the antenna. From the words you're using, I'm led to believe you've mounted the connector at the center flat plate back of the coffee can, and now the probe for the coffee can comes out of there, makes a right angle bend, and now you can move it, the probe, like the hand on a clock. Is that what you're saying, John? Over to you, K2LIW.
It's exactly what I explained. The BNC connector is on the outside of the can, but on the back of the can, dead center. And I sent you a BNC connector similar to that. I don't know if you remember it, but it had a little plug-in connection. You don't have to solder to it. And that's what I use to plug in these different antenna shapes and lengths. Some of them are rings. This is just a simple L, but you've got it right.
Have you attempted to measure the viswire of your horn antenna, your coffee can antenna, at 1.6, what is it now, 1.67 gigahertz? Did you measure that insertion? And yeah, did you measure the viswire? And by the way, is the hand of the clock in there that you're moving, is it approximately, let me think, is it in the vicinity of an inch long, 2.5 centimeters, go ahead?
It's almost 2 inches thick. I think it's like 1.75 inches. And here's what I did. I took that can, and I put a return loss bridge on it, and I got that beautiful return loss measurement at that frequency. Okay, now there's a couple of other loads where it was similar, but I picked that frequency because that was the deepest. I said, all right. Then I put it on my vector network analyzer, went into the complex mode, and it is definitely dead center of the Smith chart. If I go to those other lobes, it's way off. The inductive reactance and capacitive reactance is all wacky. So that's why I chose that particular odd frequency that I'm dealing with.
You said you went to those other lobes. I guess that means when you're sweeping in frequency, you found a couple of frequencies at which you got a good match. But the frequency you like most is 1.67 gigs, and that's where it gives you the center of the Smith chart. And by the way, does it say at the center of the Smith chart, even when you rotate it between 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and so on, the little probe inside? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Believe it or not, Dick, yes, almost dead center. It moves slightly, but not much. I mean, you can see it move, but it's maybe the width of the dot. I don't consider that a problem.
Ooh, I just thought of something else. What's the depth of your coffee can? In other words, the probe is on the back.
6 inches deep. It's 5 inches from the surface output of the can, the flat face of the can, to the antenna face. That's 5 inches. The can is 6 inches deep in itself.
Okay, so the hour hand in there is roughly 1 inch from the back wall. The horn is 6 inches deep, 6 inches in diameter. So between the probe and the mouth of the horn is roughly 5 inches. Is that what you're describing, John?
Correct.
Yeah. You've now run into one of the other very deep minefields of horns. Nobody in his right mind makes a horn where the gain and pattern is traceable to the bureau, where he doesn't have multiple wavelengths of length of horn. That probe that you've got in there, without a doubt, is launching a signal. It's not launching one signal, it's launching 3 or 4 different signals, all on exactly 1.67 gigs in your case, but it's launching a whole bunch of signals. Yeah. Every probe that you put into a horn launches a whole lot of higher order waveguide modes in the near vicinity. If the diameter of the horn will sustain the dominant mode, the fundamental frequency, so to speak, and all other modes will die out when the horn is multiple wavelengths long. Your horn is not even one wavelength long, John. Let me think about that. Yes, you're operating at around a 4 or so inch wavelength, and so you don't have anywhere near enough wavelength. Your horn is launching a whole lot of simultaneous modes, if you had one of those plotting programs that could plot the E field inside of your horn, it ain't simple, John. The fact that you can set the drop.
See, you're keeping secrets. You never told me that, Dick.
Agreed. There's something hugely wrong where you can set the probe at 8 o'clock and you get a peak of signal. 180 degrees away is the exact same polarization. You set it at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. When you set it at 2 o'clock, you should see a peak of equal magnitude and you see almost nothing. That's a strong indication that you're launching multiple waveguide modes and the length of your horn is nowhere near long enough to suppress those other modes.
Question.
Go ahead.
John, did you try to increase the frequency of the transmitter? Did you put your signal generator to the horn antenna? Did you try to find at which point you would have the most of the results from the vector network, no, from the spectrum analyzer that is connected to the receiving antenna? Back to you.
Yes, that's why I chose that frequency.
Yeah, you're at the frequency where your horn gives you maximum performance for your particular setup. But the signal coming out of that horn, if you plotted its antenna pattern and polarization characteristics, something really weird is going on because any reasonable horn launching a pure horizontally polarized signal where it gives you the maximum signal at 8 o'clock and it should have been 9 o'clock, but even that 8 o'clock performance should have been identical at 2 o'clock, and it's not.
Native frequency of the horn, could that be calculated?
You've asked a very logical sounding question. It does not have a logical answer. Every horn works at every frequency DC to light. Now, you're describing a particular performance at a particular frequency of that particular horn. It's not a valid question. You've used good words, but it can't be answered. So
you have a choice to change the resonating element inside the horn. And then you're trying to match, to have a full wavelength or the valid fraction of the wavelength of the horn at that particular diameter by changing the resonating element in the receiving part of it, and to issue.
Not a valid question. Not a valid explanation. It would take too long to figure that one out. The results you've gotten, John, because you're launching multiple modes from that probe, the probe is at the right frequency as far as your standing wave ratio is concerned. Making the right standing wave ratio of an antenna does not guarantee its performance, does not guarantee what modes you're launching into your so-called piece of waveguide. Your horn is nowhere near long enough, John. There's various ways that you can take that short horn and launch a more pure wave, but it would have to be a symmetric radiator, something like a dipole. If the thing on the back of the horn was a pure balanced dipole, two-thirds of the problem I'm giving you hints of would go away. You've got a non-symmetric load and a short number of wavelengths of horn that has multiple modes, and you're launching all of those waveguide modes. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KB2, HUC with a question.
Yeah, stand by. John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. First of all, if I can extend the length of the horn, do I have to flare it, or can I keep it the same diameter? That's one question. The next question is, I also can mount a flat disc, similar to, say, like a quarter, and I can plug that in, and its plane would be flat with the forward portion of the dish. Would that help? Instead of a piece of wire and an L, it would be a circular area like a coin.
I've got a program on my computer right now. If I call it up correctly, in the next 2 minutes, I can give you two or three of those answers. While I'm doing that, let's see what Mr. HUC's got to say. KD2HUC, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. Yeah, I'm just listening, and I was hoping maybe you could explain something, because you keep saying that,
you know, John's horn, the horn is not long enough, and therefore you're launching multiple modes. Why would the horn be launching anything? Isn't the horn the receiving antenna? I'm missing something. Back to that, KD2HUC.
I know you, but I've forgotten your name. Please tell me your name.
My name is Steve, Dick.
Yeah, forgive me because I'm so damn forgetful. Steve, whether the horn is used as a transmitter or a receiver does not matter at all. The law of reciprocity of passive antennas. Passive antennas means it doesn't contain transistors and circulators and fancy things. A passive antenna, whatever pattern, polarization, gain, everything that you measure in the transmit mode and the receive mode will be identical. That's not a problem. His probe that's launching the signal in his coffee can is a non-symmetric loading, non-symmetric launching device. If it was a pure center-fed dipole with a perfect balance, then it would be launching a pure horizontal wave in the back end of his coffee can horn. He's using a L-shaped piece of wire coming out of the center conductor of the connector on the back end of the horn on the flat plate diameter pure center of it. He's launching a non-symmetric wave. He's got the equivalent of a bent monopole launching a signal. That's launching two or three modes of waveguide mode, and the waveguide itself, the 6-inch diameter coffee can, which is only 5 more inches before open air, doesn't have anywhere near enough length to kill those higher order modes, and I'm about to find out what modes can be launched into a 6-inch diameter circular waveguide. I'm calling up that program right now. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Very good. Be interesting to see what it describes. Do you want me to go on to an additional question, basically the same thing?
What is the proper length?
Don't know that yet. We're about to come up with that. Go on with your next question, John.
Okay, Dick. I don't want to complicate it too much. There's so many questions I have about this device, and I've wasted a lot of time, spent a lot of time. Now, if I were to take this antenna and put it in a Faraday cage, all right, now we know the notch is at 1.67 gig, all right? It's resonant, that frequency. If I am listening to a receiver, and I now am listening to that frequency with a separate antenna, it's outside. I have a T in line, and I were to plug that antenna into the T. Now that antenna is in a Faraday cage, minus 85 dB Faraday cage. Not the best, but it works. Now, will that act as a notch filter if I'm listening to the same station at that frequency? Will I notice a drop in that signal by using that as sort of a trap? If you can do that and look up the thing on the computer, you're a better man than I am.
Okay. A round piece of waveguide. I'm going to answer. I'm going back to the previous question. I've got the answers for the previous question. A round piece of waveguide, exactly 6 inches in diameter. The first dominant mode is 1.15 gigahertz. You're at 1.67, no problem. That's the TE01 circular mode, circular waveguide mode. The next higher mode is TE21. Cutoff frequency there is 1.51. You're at 1.67. So you're above the frequency for that mode. The third mode is the TE01 mode, 1.91. So the first three modes that a 6-inch diameter round piece of pipe will propagate, 1.15 gigs, 1.51 gigs, 1.91 gigs. The third mode you will not support. The third mode is there. The first mode, the second mode, the third mode are there at your launching piece of L-shaped piece of wire in the back of the horn. Let me drop it. You're launching all three of those modes, and even maybe the fourth mode, 2.4 gigs, which is a TM11 mode. You're launching three or four modes simultaneously of various amplitudes and various phase angles. If the horn was long enough, the only two modes that would be supported a 1.15 and 1.51. You would support both of those, so that your horn is already too big in diameter to make sure that only one dominant mode comes out of the front end. Had your exciting device at the back of the horn not been a bent monopole, but had been a full half-wave dipole, and I can tell you how to do that. It's not as complicated as you think. It would be launching a hell of a lot less of these higher-order modes that are giving you this grief. That some of that making some sense, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
Absolutely. It sounds like I was close to target with that shape and that frequency, so at least I'm moving forward anyway.
Yeah, if you could adjust the length of your monopole so that it gives you a good response below 1.5. And the 1.5 is your second mode. 1.15 is your first mode of a 6-inch diameter round pipe. If you were launching a signal, let me pick a number, 1.3 gigs. It's above the lower order mode, but lower than the second order mode. You only would propagate one mode if you were launching 1.3 gigs. So if you had a purely symmetrical dipole at 1.3 gigs, you'd be way ahead of the game of the problem you're discussing. And if you want to be sure now that only that mode is present, I would make your horn, which is 6 inches deep, I would make it 12 inches deep. By the time you go a couple of wavelengths, nothing but the dominant mode is left. Everything else becomes evanescent, gets suppressed. Then you would have a pure output horizontal wave, if you know what I mean. It's not going to take you a hell of a lot of hardware, but you've walked into a very interesting trap, John, that's not at all obvious, and the number of books you could go to that would explain this to you is very few. Over to you, John. And they're not written in English. They're written in this really fancy mathematics. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, one question comes to mind. Now, my coffee can has a rim that takes a pop top. All right, so I probably would have to remove that rim because that would be an intruding partition between the two cylinders when I mate them together. So should I remove that rim?
Not necessarily. Give me some words on that rim. Is that rim a folded over piece of sheet metal where the can normally goes, and that rim is now something larger in diameter on the outside, which is almost irrelevant. As long as that rim that you're discussing is not making the apparent diameter significantly different from 6 inches, you could ignore it. So is that rim sticking inward or only outward? Over to you, John.
It sticks inward, it's reducing the diameter, but it's only approximately a quarter of an inch thick. So maybe I'm losing a total of a half inch from, so it's 5.5 inches instead.
Okay, so in the vicinity of the rim, you're saying a 6-inch diameter becomes a 5-inch diameter, or 5.5? Are you telling me that that rim sticks in a half inch, or would you say it sticks in a quarter inch? Yeah, run that by again, John, go ahead.
Radially, it's a quarter of an inch. So if you add those two together, that's a half inch. Now, this is approximately, it may be less than that, but approximately, let's say, if the can's 6 inches, that would reduce it to a 5.5 inch on that opening.
Which now has a brand new cutoff frequency, if you know what I mean. A 5-inch diameter pipe has a higher cutoff frequency. But now the number of wavelengths of that is the thickness of the sheet metal. And the sheet metal is what, 10,000 of an inch thick? John, go ahead.
Well, it has a ripple in it, so maybe a little more than that.
A ripple in it. Can you mail me a picture of this thing? What brand of coffee is this?
They're all basically the same, like Maxwell House. I think it's a 1-pound can, and it's sort of like a paint can. When you pop the top off a paint can, do you know that rim? But it's a lot smaller than that. But that's basically the rim.
Wow. Okay, so the way a paint can cover works is identical to the way this cover works. In other words, in the case of a paint can, you stick a screwdriver under there to take the cover off. In your case, you stick your spoon under that rim in order to take the cover off. Is that the way this thing works?
Yeah, it's a plastic cover that pops into that rim, and there's a little tab. You just pull on that tab, and it pops right out of that ring.
Yeah, that's another compensating factor, which really means you're setting up a standing wave between the back end and the front end of the horn. So you're launching three modes, non-symmetric modes because of a non-symmetric launching structure, and you've also got this perturbation device at the mouth of your horn, which is creating a visual back and forth. Other than that, you've got a pretty nice antenna there, John. You need a much more symmetric launching structure. You need a lot more length. I think you've got to cut away that rim to be more pure. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, that's the first thing I'll do. I'll either do that or get a can without a rim, and I'll add another can the same diameter to it. Should I keep the shape circular? Don't change it, don't squash it.
Absolutely, keep it circular. But now, I'm going to have to show you various ways. If you take a look at the August issue, 1972, QST magazine, there I've got a round horn with a purely symmetrical dipole feed. And so, if you're a QST, if you're an ARL member, you're allowed to go into the article archives, and you can call up that article, August QST 1972, and there you'll find a way of making a purely symmetric dipole feed for the back end of a feed horn. I did it at 1296 megacycles, close enough. In fact, you can build that exact same structure, John, your head.
And you said September of 72?
August 1972, that's the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish antenna with feed horn. And so the feed horn design there, the launching structure for the feed horn design, I know you can build that. It's not very complicated. Over to you, John.
Okay, that's what I will do. I will look that up, and I will extend that coffee can, and then I'll bug you with the next set of questions from when I get that done. Very good, Dick. Thank you.
Now, we're at the mailbag section of the TechNet. So, you know, I did have one other guy who we're supposed to go to. We're supposed to go to KC2PYY Ed. Let's see if Ed is there. KC2PYY, PYT? Can't read my own call letters.
Yeah, PYT.
Are you there, Ed? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yes, I am still here, KC2PYT, if you've got time for me.
We're going to make time for you, John. Fire away with your question. And by the way, which are you coming into? How are you coming into us? Because we're getting a different beep from you.
Dick.
I'm coming in through EchoLink tonight. So my question is kind of specific, and it's dealing with Baofengs. I've got two Baofengs here. This is going back to a repeater project I'm working on. And I'm trying to take the output of one Baofeng on the received side and put it directly in as the microphone input of another Baofeng for the transmitter antenna, for the transmitter. The problem is, when I do that, it immediately triggers the PTT. Which is to say, when both radios are on and this cable is connecting the two, the PTT on the transmitter is triggered, and it will transmit for as long as the radio is set to allow a continuous transmission. There's no box turned on. There's no nothing being received on the receiving antenna. On the receiving radio, it's just that when these two radios are on and the speaker of one is plugged into the microphone of the other, the transmitting antenna keys down.
Could have walked down resistor between the two of them.
Yeah, the way the PTT on many of these radios works is that when you push the PTT button, you're creating a partial ground on the so-called hot wire for the audio. You've got a lot more experience in this, Edward, in this area, Eric. So tell him what he should do. I'm guessing he's going to have to put a coupling capacitor